The main thing that I've been thinking about when I've been going through this space is that we have both a strong search for truth, but we have approached it very differently. Mm-hmm. So Bitcoin have allowed me to let go of my intellect and focus on my inner guidance, while you seem to have taken the almost opposite route, and Bitcoin have allowed you maybe to dive into your intellect even more. So my first question is this a conscious choice from your side to approach truth via the intellect rather than through experience and inner guidance?
No, it's not a conscious choice. And, you know, I, of course, accept that that's the way that you interpret it. But my approach has been to seek truth in all places and in all forms. And, you know, I've certainly had many experiences, and I certainly value the truths, and I certainly allow my actions and my life to be guided by a less, let's say, intellectual understanding or approach to truth. I also think that other approaches, like, let's say, broadly speaking, the intellectual or rational approach to truth, can be very interesting, but also can be very useful. And, you know, I would never be so bold to make a claim about, you know, final truth or anything like that. But I think that the best approach, at least that I've found, is to approach it from all angles so that you have as much context and vision as possible, and then explore the depths of each side, or of each angle rather, and see what conjures up. So, you know, the piece, I think, is, while I think the piece does kind of borrows from some of my pursuits of truth that are maybe outside the intellectual realm, I think, you know, what I tried to do there was marry some of them. And because, you know, we understand, well, it's easier for to bring others along sometimes when you let me gather my thoughts here. I think the rational, logical approach to some of the themes that I explored in the piece is lacking today. So it's not that it's my exclusive method of pursuing truth, but it's one that I felt for this piece of writing was one that I wanted to try to explore further, because I felt there was a relative lack of it in today's discourse.
Okay. Yeah, you mentioned in the piece a few times about alternative ways to experience truth.
But if I'm not approaching that answer properly, I'd be interested in hearing more about what you mean in terms of the approach you've taken.
Yeah, when I say like that, I've surrendered my intellect, so I don't take decisions. I don't make decisions from an intellect. So I feel and I sense, and so every day is random in that sense, because I stopped using the intellect as a guidance.
It's hard to imagine that that would be something that would be total. You know, I understand the kind of allowing the pathless path to kind of open up in front of you sort of thing, but is it possible to completely do away with the intellect?
Well, the intellect has more of a like a secretary role in my life. So taking notes and comparing notes, and so I use the intellect to communicate with others, but it's really in the hierarchy of how I move forward in life. It has a very, very small role compared to the inner. Well, let's move on. And we have, so I want to talk a little bit about mental models. So obviously, you know, that all we use is mental models. We use these to make sense of the reality. We use them to communicate with each other. Have you thought about why humans tend to hold on to, identify with, or even defend their models?
Yeah, absolutely. I think primarily it's a matter of comfort. You know, as you say, these models, we adopt them because they're useful, at least for a time, and changing them out or revivifying them can be an uncomfortable process, because basically what you're saying is the assumptions or a priori axioms on which they're based may have been wrong or need upgrading. And that, you know, that can kind of shake up your entire worldview. And because we predicate who we are and our personality and our values and all those things on our worldview, if when we encounter the necessity or the proclivity for it to be shaken up, then that can be very uncomfortable. And this is why I think people hold on to rigid worldviews out of a desire for comfort, out of a desire to avoid fear, out of a desire to avoid, you know, the unknown. And this is always the case, because that's the very purpose, right? And Peterson talks a lot about this, is these frameworks are a modality for encountering the unknown and encountering it optimally, but they do need to be regenerated. Of course, this is the role of the regenerative hero, to confront the unknown and revivify the old worldview that is no longer tenable or optimized. And I think in the world today, and perhaps, you know, forever, part of the human condition, perhaps, that even though those worldviews are hard won, and we become so attached to them, and we derive and predicate our identity so much on them, that when they become challenged, even in the face of obvious, you know, information that they need to be updated, because the results of holding on to them too rigidly are increasingly dire, you know, it's increasingly netting bad outcomes. There's still this tendency, this stubbornness to hold on to them because of the discomfort that letting go of them and revivifying them instills. And this is why the heroic journey, again, that Peterson refers to so much, one of the primary elements is courage, because you need to be able to cast off, you know, the former framework and confront the unknown without as much certainty as before, in order to regenerate the framework so that it's more optimized for the circumstance now and into the future. And this is a constant process that must be done. And it seems to me that so many in the world today just refuse to engage that process for a variety of reasons.
Yeah. So you are not a stranger to thinking that you are talking to your projection of me, and I'm talking to my projection of you.
Can you say that again?
Yeah, because everything, we use just mental models, right? So for me to communicate with you, I use everything from my past to sort of analyze who you are, or like who I think right. You are, who I'm talking to. So I'm not actually talking to you, but I'm talking to my projection of you.
Yeah, I would agree. Although I would say that the me that you think you're talking to is actually a me, right? So it's like there's truth to it. So I wouldn't say it's entirely artificial, but I do know what you mean.
What kind of truth would that be? It's just subjective truth, right? Or do you think it's any objective truth in any of this?
Well, I think your subjective appraisal of who I am, there's a truth in that, if for no other reason, because it's the truth that's going to orient your behavior towards me, you know? And so there may be an objective truth of who I am, though at a certain level that somewhat seems absurd. You know, one of the things I've always found difficult is to understand how I am perceived by others, right? And perhaps we're all social creatures. So maybe we all stumble upon this at some point, but, you know, I've never been able to get very far with that, you know? So the punchline is like, I have no real idea how I'm perceived by people. But I think at least one of the reasons why my mind kind of puts up a brick wall to that and doesn't give me much insight there is just because it's so impractical, right? Because as you say, everybody is seeing something slightly or grossly different, right? Because of the different worldviews and all the different ways in which they're interpreting who I am and my behavior and that kind of stuff. And so, you know, what is the objective truth? You know, like maybe at a core level there is, but in terms of your subjective interpretation, it's not just imagination, right? If you believe it's real and you act as though it's real, then the fact that you're interacting with me or observing me has generated that in you, that there's something real in there, right? And so maybe it's just semantics where we're talking about subjective versus objective, but you know, I just wanted to make the distinction.
Yeah, that's what we are diving into here today. But I can explain a little bit more this question about why humans hold on to their beliefs. Like you explained, it's really good. And I've also seen a relationship between people's inner strength and their ability to not be attached to their beliefs. Like you talked about this, that it's in society today, many people are attached to their beliefs, and this leads to a lot of problems. Mm-hmm. So what I experienced when I moved away from the intellect was that the ideas, when you don't need to hold on to them anymore, you don't need to pick like, oh, I believe this or I believe this. So it's just more floating, you know, because you're not attached to the intellectual models anymore. Mm-hmm. And what this creates is an interesting situation when you have more reference points, because you don't pick like, oh, this is correct and this is not correct. So instead, you hold more reference points in your awareness at the same time. So rather than relying on a certain model or a certain belief or a certain philosopher, you're just experiencing many reference points at the same time. And then you can take decisions in the present moment just by making an evaluation of the reference points in the moment.
Yeah. I mean, I think I understand what you're saying, but it's still the issue of the reference points and how they're hierarchically organized to determine what your action ultimately is, right? So there is a degree of preference and organization in order for action to occur. And so, you know, I agree with you in terms of, broadly speaking, not being married to too many systems of value or an overly rigid system of value or dogma or something like that. But I guess one of the things that I'm trying to explore, and I guess the right piece of writing is a part of that, is what is the most optimal way to organize those systems of value so that your action is optimized.
Yeah, but that is when you take your actions based on intellect or rational mind. So I have that equation taken out of it. So I don't decide my actions based on mental activity.
Well, how are they decided?
Because I'm drawn to different things from right, inside.
But the fact that you're drawn is an assignment of value to the thing that's drawing you. So there's still a system of value at work. It's not like there's no orientation happening.
Yeah, but this is what I leave to my higher self, my highest self. Because from my experience, I see that my higher self has access to much more information through time and space, because the higher self is outside of time and space. So it operates non-linearly, not linearly, right? So I leave all the calculation, like what is good, what, where I should go at which time. I leave it to that, like you can say, unconscious process. Unconscious to the ego, but conscious to the higher self.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, that's interesting. I understand what you're saying. I think for me, I'm just, again, whether it's the conscious self or the unconscious self that's oriented towards that, whose orientation and the values that serve to orient it, whichever one is being engaged to foster action, I'm intrigued by and interested in knowing what those values and that orientation is, right? So I can accept that someone may act somewhat unconsciously and allow it just to kind of flow. But action requires valuation and choice. as I explained a little bit in the piece, and I'm interested in knowing or in investigating the different systems of, you know, knowledge and thought, you know, now and obviously in earlier times, that attempt to elucidate how to most optimally construct those systems, whether then you choose to engage in them consciously or not.
Yeah. So you're investigating different rational approaches, but what mm-hmm. if we were not supposed to use our rational mind to take decisions? If this was a mistake, have you considered it?
Yeah, I've considered it. I struggle to. Well, I mean, let me tell you the perhaps dichotomy that I. One of the reasons why I'm so interested in pursuing this is because in my moments of however, whatever you want to call it, nirvana, enlightenment, bliss, union with the fullness of the present moment, however we want to characterize that state, that is a, you know, a perfectly peaceful and united and unseparated state. But it's not a state of a great deal of action or creation, at least in my experience. And so I'm still wondering, well, one, what the optimized state, you know, most of the time might be, and two, how much creation that state, or how much creation flows from the different states that one can be in, and how much creation should we seek or should we be a part of, you know? And to make a very simple example of this, you could say, like, well, is the amount of creation in terms of the modern, you know, hyper technological world with spaceships and, you know, all that jazz, is that like right creation? Is that the result of optimized right action? Or is absolutely nothing, you know, kind of being a monk in a temple, but always in that state of bliss, the correct amount of creation or right action? And so, you know, part of the inquiry that I've been pursuing is wrestling with all these different states of consciousness and being, and investigating them and trying to determine the proper, trying to determine right action, I guess, under the assumption that right action exists, and then trying to determine what right action looks like for me in, you know, in my experience of life.
Very good. But from my experience, they are not separate. I mean, you don't need to be spaced out and inactive and then to be activating an ego and to be active. This is how it was for me also before, but your spirit, I mean, your inner self is actually very curious, very energetic, very, very lively being. It's just that if we don't let it come properly into the body, he's not able to express himself like that. So in the beginning, we just experience the spirit as more like a mood or a state. But as we give it more and more room, and this is what I think Bitcoin has given me, because I was able to free up time to really let the spirit come in. And when we do this, it just starts flowing from inside. You know, it's just the spirit wants to use the body and do stuff on earth. So then it just feels a little bit sad to use just the mind, like overwrite the spirit and just use the mind to do what we think we need to do to survive and so on.
So yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's an overriding. I guess I'm saying I haven't discerned the proper relationship between the two yet, despite, you know, many years of investigation and stuff like that. And for what it's worth, you know, subjectively, it seems like I'm closing the gap to some degree there, and it feels very good. But, you know, the mind to me is not an enemy. It exists for a reason, and I'm trying to, you know, trying to determine the best possible way to engage it. I mean, I could ask you, you know, we're having this conversation here today. Well, why are we having it? Surely the idea emerged and you thought, oh, maybe this would be an interesting conversation. And so we have that, and inherent in that assumption or that desire or that impulse are a number of different, values throughout. And so we still engage the mind to act, even if the impulse comes from a deeper knowing or truth or wisdom. And so, you know, I'm trying to determine the best marriage between the two, again, to optimize my action as a human being in my circumstance and my experience of life, you know? So, and I think that's to your point earlier about worldviews, I think that's something that so many people have just relinquished entirely, that journey, you know, determining that for oneself, because it's, you know, fraught with uncertainty. It may forever be uncertain, at least certain aspects of it. And at the very least, it can be very uncomfortable and all the rest of it. And I think many people have just opted for the security of known dogma, known thinking, known ideologies, known philosophies, so that they don't have to generate themselves and they don't have to exist in that quasi no man's land of becoming, let's say.
Yes, absolutely. And this is why I think I was guided to talk to you, because you're really honestly curious, and your writing, even though it doesn't correlate with my experience to 100%, I really feel a connection with that seeker for truth spirit that comes through your piece. And also when I heard you talking in other podcasts and so on. So I'm glad you're here. Let's talk about goal setting now, because in several parts you write that, we have truer and truer models of reality, and then we set goals based on these models. For example, you're right here, as we are pulled forward by our ideals or future image of ourselves, our mind becomes tuned to see opportunities that can get us there more quickly or efficiently. So, this is something that many businessmen and entrepreneurs use. But have you ever thought of any dangers or negative side effects of this approach, goal setting?
Yeah, it probably came through as more narrow in the piece than I intended, you know, as just kind of having a goal or an ambition and striving to achieve it. I mean, I don't know if I left in or out a part ultimately in the piece where, you know, the ideal could also just be a way of being, you know, a process of engaging reality. It doesn't have to be like, well, I want to achieve this, or I want to have this, or in 20 years, I want to, yeah, this is my image of my life. I think it works on all domains. So you could say that it could, of course, be that method of moving forward could be improperly constructed. And I do make this case a little bit in the piece where, and this is somewhat tantamount to having the wrong God, you know, because as I say in the piece, whatever is at the top of your value hierarchy, you know, the thing you're striving for the most, the thing that has the most motivational significance for you, that's what's going to orient your system of valuation and therefore all your behavior. And it's going to kind of dictate how you move through the world. And the degree to which that is aligned with the greatest truth, let's say. So like you have a lowercase g God, whatever your ambition or ideal or goal is, because that orients your behavior. To the extent that that is optimized for capital G God, like the truest truth, I think that's what dictates the greatest success. So you might be successful at achieving a subordinate goal or like a transient or material goal. But in terms of your your optimization of the experience of life as a human being, it seems to me that the religious assertion is that there's a qualitative distinction between of what is at the top of your hierarchy and the thing that is rightfully there because of the life that it actualizes are the, you know, the quote unquote principles of God that, you know, various religious and spiritual systems have attempted to articulate or even articulated that they can't be articulated, but in some manner spoke to them. That if, and so in the piece, those are the, what those things, sorry, what that places at the top of the hierarchy is what most dictates quote unquote success in life. And I realize that that can be a very difficult thing to determine what success means, and it's very subjective, but this is why in the piece, and Peterson often uses kind of, you know, bringing more good and useful order into the world. And so I think to answer your question, yes, of course it can be led astray because you can have the wrong thing orienting your behavior, and it's going to elicit so many behaviors that may not be good for you or the people with whom you're sharing an environment with, right? But if you have the proper thing at the top of your hierarchy, that you're striving towards the proper thing, then I think it's well, the assertion is that that's most capable of generating good outcomes for you and the people with whom the environment is shared.
Yeah. Maybe said in some other words, I mean, you have basically, it's built on assumptions because you have a self-image that can never be true because it is subjective, right? So whatever we think of ourselves at any point in time is never true. It's just a very, very limited version of who we can be. And then we have on the other side, we have the worldview that can never be true also because it's the way we see the world, always subjectively. So we have two very fluid concepts that can never be true. And then we use those to determine goals. And then these goals have us being busy, spending time doing stuff between two lies, we can say, to be harsh. So we are busy doing a lot of stuff between A and B. And what's happening then is that we are sort of missing the present moment. And this is also what maybe I wanted to chip in with here, because actually when I was preparing this, I was thinking present moment is the window to God. Maybe someone else said it before, but it was just because in the present moment, this is when you get that presence and you can feel truth more. So if we are busy doing all these goal settings, and then actually we have a risk of coming further from God or truth or reality because we're chasing lies.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very, this is an assertion that lies at the foundation of many spiritual and religious traditions, right? That the present moment is the window to God, you know, that the absolute stillness and union with the present moment is the greatest experience of God that one can have. And I'm very receptive to that. But again, in the example that I was using, I understand what you mean about both our perception of ourselves and our worldview. But it's also, you know, I explore this very briefly in the piece. And unfortunately, in the interest of brevity, I, you know, a lot of those sections should have been very lengthy chapters instead of just a few paragraphs. So, you know, perhaps I'll expound upon them further in the future. But, you know, this is why I think, and the example I use is that perhaps it's the case that all sort of transient goals are somewhat susceptible to the circumstance that you just described. But if your greatest orienting value is liberation and the truthful information that persists allows you to pursue it, let's say, or expedites your movement toward it, then that I think is less susceptible to the pitfall that you're describing. And it's also more generally applicable. You know, so we're dealing with obviously very difficult to articulate topics here. And, you know, ultimately, if we're talking about, you know, God and pure truth, then we should just sit here in silence, right? That would be the appropriate way to have a discussion about that stuff. But soon as we bring these things into the realm of, as you say, mind and intellect and word and language, then we inevitably lose perhaps the foundational essence. But here we are nonetheless trying to, because I think extracting some element of that, you know, pure stillness of God, let's say, into our lives can still be beneficial. And that's why I think we pursue these sorts of, this kind of knowledge. But in the piece, I agree with what you're saying, but I don't think we're lying to ourselves, you know, whether it's due to a false perception of ourselves or a false worldview, if we simply attempt to see and speak truth whenever we can, even if most times maybe we can't, maybe we're not capable. But to the extent that we are capable, that seems to be the best approach. And I think if that process is engaged properly, it allows us to move closer to union with the thing that grants most liberation, which, you know, you might say is God, at least in terms of the way we're dealing with this conversation. So in that sense, if your highest value is truth, it most orients you towards union with the highest ideal, which is perhaps liberation from the incessant ego-based planning and meddling of the mind, and you unite with something far more universal. You know, I'm receptive to that too, but the reason why I think it's still useful and interesting to explore it in the sort of way that I was exploring it, because I think that process and that kind of architecture of action is applicable both in a useful, truthful, noble sort of sense, but it can also be, of course, the same architecture is what people engage when that process leads to bad outcomes, right? So it seems like a similar architecture can lead in both directions. And our task perhaps is to elucidate the proper direction and, you know, do our individual best to engage it and construct it optimally for ourselves.
Yeah, it makes sense. And even though now a large part of my life is driven from inside, I still can relate to, you know, because I want more inner personal power, for example. So I do align my actions with more towards truth like you and towards personal power, and because I think this is very beneficial. So yeah, I think we're on the same page.
And that's kind of what I was getting at, because you just said you want more personal power, right? You want to align yourself more with truth, and so there's still a desire there, and it's not bad that it's a desire, because I think there's a recognition of the value of the thing that you're trying to align or unite with. And so part of the engagement of your mind, your logic, your reason, is to try to see how you might orient and access that more.
And then it's also that the mind interprets the inner signals and sort of, so where your spirit wants to lead you. And then the intellect picks up on this. And then the intellect sort of helps the spirit to move into that direction. So it's like the secretary, like I said in the beginning, that the intellect sort of helping the spirit to.
Yeah, it's like so many things, you know, it's a double-edged sword, you know, and there's a yin and yang to so many things, and tools can be weapons and yada, yada, yada. So I think something very similar is going on there with the ego or the thinking mind or the rational or logical mind. You know, it can be very detrimental if not restrained and engaged properly, but it perhaps is also critical to the other experiences, the more higher experiences or the other methods of existing that we might be able to gain access to. And perhaps we wouldn't without at least the existence or, as you say, secretarial help in some kind of that other part of ourselves and our minds.
Yeah, and this sort of leads into the next question, because I want to talk about living inside out versus outside in. And you have this paragraph that I will read here now. The more attuned you are to truth, the more accurately your internal map reflects outward reality, the better prepared you are to exchange information and actions with that reality. Now,
yeah, that was a quote from an anonymous Reddit user that I put in.
Yeah, it was a quote. Yeah, yeah. So this is just sort of symbolizing the outside in mindset, because you're trying to change your inside according to the external or to the market or whatever, and this is just opposite of spiritual thought, because spiritual thought is like you clean up inside and then your external reality will flip. So now it's the question here, what is the mirror? Is the inside the determining factor and outside is the mirror, or is the external world the determining factor and whatever happens in the external world affect us internally?
Well, it seems obvious to me that it's a relationship. Again, neither exists in a vacuum. And so both can influence the other. You know, so I think what that person was meaning in their quote was, you know, they were taking a higher order. You know, they weren't just talking about culture, which I refer to later in the piece, but, you know, they were basically saying, like, if you're more attuned to, and this is kind of hard to articulate, but if you're more attuned to how reality works, right, like the structure of reality, if you're more unified with that, then it's most likely that you're in a better position to engage with that reality, because we don't exist in a vacuum where we engage in relationship to all the different constituent components of our reality. And the degree to which you kind of purify and clarify your own perception to see the truth in the reality with which you're engaging, then of course, the more optimized you are to have a relationship and a fruitful relationship with that reality. So in that particular quote, I would disagree. I don't think it's reflective of, you know, a perspective or point of view from either internal or external. I think it's commenting on how to construct an optimized relationship and how to construct the optimized and inevitable relationship that exists between the two points of view or constituent parts of that. And then later I talk about how culture is kind of an external manifestation of our minds. And I don't touch on it much, but I've been, you know, culture is obviously, again, it's a feedback loop. It's still a relationship. We manifest our mind in culture, and then culture influences the contents of our mind and what we end up manifesting and so on and so forth. And this is why I think it's so important that culture is predicated on the best possible principles or rails or values or ideals, because it will generate and it will influence so much of the contents of our minds. And it will, it's such a important, it's the other half of that relationship. And so I think the degree to which it's predicated on the proper foundation, let's say, and, you know, in the context of this, like, we can just simply say like a foundation of Bitcoin versus fiat, I think the former would foster a culture that is so much more, that fosters and embodies the principles of that foundation more, which would be, let's say, truth and sovereignty and freedom and those sorts of things. So, but in the quote from the Reddit user, there was a much higher level comment, I guess.
Yeah, maybe I picked the wrong quote, but it's also typical for mind-based people to think that we need to do things in the external world, while
we do, don't we? I mean, we're physical beings acting in the world, so that relationship is inevitable.
But the script is in the inside. So, for example, if you have a trauma when you're a kid, so that script is inside you, and then that keeps repeating the whole life. If you try to fix this in the external world, you will never solve it. You maybe cope with it in different ways, but you can't solve it because the problem lies on the inside.
Sure. No, I know. I know what you're saying. Mm-hmm. I don't think you're commenting on what I took as the intent or meaning of that person's quote. I know what you're saying, you know, that, you know, we can't try to make the external world conform to the imperfections or something like that of our internal world, right? Like our problems and, you know, so much of our issues are self-constructed, let's say, and their resolution lies internally rather than externally. I'm very receptive to that, but I think they were commenting on not just an individual's experience of reality, but, you know, the whole of reality taken together, the individual and the whole world, and how to, and the best basis by which to construct a relationship between the two, not necessarily favoring one versus the other.
Yeah, but if we look away from this quote for a while and just look at if it's inside out or outside in, then the mental approach to this, the intellectual approach, is usually outside in. So you try to, you strive, you work hard and so on. In the external world to feel better on the inside. Now, that's the outside in. But, and then you're busy doing that. So you're not solving your childhood traumas and so on. So that's because you think that the solutions are in the external. You spend all your time and all your, you know, value hierarchies to just trying to fix the problems outside. Now I'm doing the opposite. Because I'm not doing that, and I think it's inside out. So I spend most of my time sorting out my inner traumas and stuff like this. So because most things are like we want anyway, it's based in insecurities that we have from the past. So it's a big risk to run around in the external world and do stuff without looking why we're even doing it. So
yeah, sure.
For me, it's just like diving into why we want to do something. And then when you solve all of this, you solve all the stuff, the insecurities, why you want to do stuff. That's when the spirit can start to come in and do stuff, you know, and then we don't do stuff because of insecurity. We don't do stuff because of fear or shame or guilt, because we sort of sorted that out. So we clean up on the inside all the distorted reasons why we do stuff. And then it's room, it's space for the spirit to come in. And then we start doing things because we like to, because we want to, because we have passion.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
So the next chapter here, the religion. I mean, you brought up a really interesting, optimistic view of religions. And it took me a while to understand what you were talking about. And then I was like, started thinking positively of religions, and I'm not used to this. Oh, wow. Yeah, maybe they were really good and maybe they just tried the best. But then again, I went back maybe to my old mindset, or I don't know what happened, but then it just feels like, because I'm all about human potential, you know, I've been exploring myself from inside and just, you know, the energy body and how everything is vibrating and everything is, you know, is chakras, and it's so many amazing things on the inside. And then you have all these religions, and they are more trying to suffocate humans' ability to go inwards and find their own power. So while you're painting them in sort of a positive light to have like guidance for how to live, yeah, guidance to be slaves. This is what I see. So you have the religions just pushing down the people and always making sure that they look up to authority. And the authority say, yeah, do like this, look like this, and you will be happy. You will come to heaven or whatever. I think it's just different forms of suppression, similar to what governments are doing. So for me, again, it's not easy for me to see that optimistic view you were painting.
Yeah, well, I agree, first of all. I mean, I mentioned in the piece that the institutions of religion, I'm highly critical of. What I've been exploring for a long time, and what I guess partially alluded to or elucidated in the piece, is that just because the enterprise of religion, just because that's been co-opted by institutions that would seek to take that power and influence for their own ends, just because that seems to have been the case. And it's also important that we recognize, and you know, I've been a critic of religion for most of my life, so you know, I certainly appreciate those arguments, but we kind of look at it and say, oh, religion has been such a blight on humanity for so long. And we look at, you know, the Inquisition and other horrors, and you know, we tend to think things can be more utopian than they can be. You know, it may be the case, and you know, and perhaps history is proof of this, that without religion things would have been worse. You know, that's entirely possible. So I'm not really that interested in delving too deep into the criticisms. I'm more interested in looking at what of value or validity is represented in this enterprise, because the enterprise of religion, the enterprise of trying to determine the highest values that we engage with as human beings experiencing reality in this world, has been, and you know, as a result, how best to engage this world with one another and ourselves, that's been central to every civilization that we have records on, you know, ever since, you know, the time of Sumerians all the way up to the present day. I mean, this has been a central concern. And I'm willing to concede certain elements of ignorance and power and all the rest of it, but not exclusively. I think there's a element of that that is genuine and sincere and good. And so I focus in this piece mostly on Christianity because, one, the title Messiah is mostly used in relation to Jesus Christ. And Peterson has focused most of his work on a Judeo-Christian religion. And because I cite him so extensively, that's kind of the notion, the sense that it took. But, you know, I'm very interested in, you know, many of the world's religions. And the reason why I'm interested in them is not because of the dogma and institutions and systems of power that have formed around them over the ages. Again, I'm critical of that because I think that serves to sever people off from the actual source of a lot of this wisdom. But I do think that if you investigate them enough, you see at the foundation very, very similar things, very similar ideas, very similar ineffable realities, very similar values. And it's those that I think the enterprise was attempting to, one, discern, and then, you know, possibly communicate, possibly help other people along in their own journeys by certain methods. And then, because we seem to be such a corruptible species, we end up, you know, taking what was perhaps initially a noble enterprise in the attempt to an altruistic enterprise to help people. And it ends up being co-opted. And as a result, people are led astray by nefarious motivations, let's say. And so a lot of people reached out to me since the piece. And, you know, there's this in Bitcoin recently, there seems to be a lot of people revisiting Christianity, for example. And I think that's one of the tendencies of Bitcoin is that it is kind of a perceptive filter and it changes how you see so many things. And so you revisit a lot of stuff. And I think it's good that people are revisiting that system because I think it's the height of hubris and arrogance that in today's modern culture, there hasn't even really been a discussion about doing away with it. I mean, a lot of us, myself included, grew up in secular households and it was just de facto assumed that religion was just either juvenile nonsense or superstitious nonsense or, you know, a corrupt system of trying to control people. And therefore we did away with it without even a proper, you know, discussion or investigation. And I think that's the height of arrogance and hubris. I think there is tremendous wisdom in those systems, if not applied in the way that they in their current form, but there's something of value in there. And so I'm interested in exploring what that value might be in all of these systems, and then not dictating, you know, what a new globalized system of value, belief, spirituality, what have you, should be, but allowing the truth to move through, to come through me and my actions and those other people who are kind of thinking and seeing things in a similar way. And let's see how those truths and those values become ritualized in some way. Because you can make the case that, you know, the attempt, this altruistic attempt to help people along the path was co-opted, right? And so we have to be very careful, but I do think that the things that we end up ascribing the most value to in our life that become the most meaningful to us, I do think it will be the case that ritual forms around it to remind us of how important it is, how much we value it, how sacred it is. You know, a very simple one could be saying something before you have dinner, for example, a recognition of the gratitude for the sustenance that you're about to receive so that you can transmute that nutrition into your life and the good that your life represents or is capable of. You know, that's a sacred act, in my opinion. And so will other rituals, both, you know, small, like some kind of a grace before dinner, or large, like more communal activities, emerge around this a new and novel belief system? I think the answer is probably yes, but I don't think it can be dictated to people. I think what we're going to have to do is do our best to see with clarity and speak and seek truth and let that orient and dictate our behavior and our action. And let's see what truth compels us to do, because that's one of, I guess, my abiding faiths, is that the more you confront truth, and again, this is all forever going to be subjective, right? But that union that, you know, we've referred to here already, you know, that stillness, that union with the present moment, that nirvana, whatever you want to call it, how is that truth influencing and coming through your behavior? And what does that mean for an individual, for a family, for a community, for a culture, for humanity? These are all massively unknown questions, but I do think it's an inevitable process that we're all participating in. And so I guess all we can do is do our best to participate in it in the best possible way. And so, you know, I guess that's part of the motivation for the things that I do.
Okay. But it's, I can sort of sense an assumption that people will continue to live outside in. And as long as people live outside in, they will not resolve their inner conflicts, and they will be lost, and they will need leaders, and then they will need people to lead them.
Yeah, but
why have religions when people can just find themselves and lead themselves rather than be led?
Well, they can. So I don't agree with the characterization, but I think they can. And I don't think anything I said contradicts that. What I'm saying is that even if people live in the manner that you think is optimized here, we're inside out, it will still be characterized by certain actions, right? Whether the motivation for that is an attempt to fix the outside world or fix the inside world. And it's still going to be characterized by meaning and value. And so when those things come together to elicit actions taken by an individual, interactions with people in a family, in a community, et cetera, there will be certain things that characterize those actions, and we will ascribe value to certain actions over others as a result of that, you know, call it inner wisdom or inner truth or what have you. And so I'm just saying that I'm not saying that we need another dogmatic institution of religion. I'm saying that I think it's inevitable that we hold up and sanctify the aspects of ourselves and our consciousness and the things of utmost meaning. We sanctify or remind ourselves of them in some way, and they become central to our individual lives, our family lives, our cultures, et cetera. And I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with that. The biggest pitfall is delegating or giving up one's power or one's own sovereignty over their truth to another and allowing someone else to dictate what that might be. I'm just saying that whatever people end up finding throughout through that journey of themselves, it's going to influence their life and in terms of the actions that they take, and then the actions that they take that are most meaningful will probably become elevated and ritualized and sanctified in some way.
Good explanation. You know, when I was reading your piece towards the end, then I got this vision that, you know, Moses and the Ten Commandments, you know, and the burning bush and stuff, mm-hmm. and then Satoshi and Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have here people going out and receiving truths, and they spread this truth in society. And back then, it was truths that helped them, hopefully, get along and work together in their stage of evolution, I would say. And now we have Satoshi here bringing us something that can take us to the next level of consciousness, to the next level of civilization.
You know, the point I made in the piece was basically that revelation, you know, if we want to call it that, and again, it might just be extremely profound thoughts. You know, we don't know where thoughts come from. And I certainly don't know how one distinguishes revelation from simply wisdom that emerges within oneself, but let's just use that term because it's familiar. But so revelation, as you say, may have come down to someone like Moses or Muhammad, and they articulate the wisdom or the revelation that has come to them. And in the landscape, the technological and cultural landscape of their time, the only way that they could communicate or even attempt to instantiate in some way the wisdom, presuming that it was wisdom, was to write it down, to preach it, to share it, to speak it, etc. And you know, the corollary to Satoshi is that he existed in a time and technological landscape where effectively another world is being built, and that's the digital world. And so his revelation, and I think, you know, the interesting thing is that these revelations, and this is what why I'm interested in what sits at the foundation of so many religions, is that they tend to communicate very similar things. Now, maybe they get overly complex and they get co-opted throughout the ages, as we've already discussed, but at the foundation of them, oftentimes, is the divinity of the individual and the, let's say, the primacy of truth. And let's say the connecting force or the all-encompassing force of love. And it's, you know, so it's interesting to me that one, because of the technological landscape, Satoshi was able to take his revelation, right, his thoughts, and he was able to not just preach them or speak them or write them, but actually build them into an emerging world, an emerging landscape of meaning and action, even if it's only digital action. And that his revelation contains very similar underpinnings as many of those that came before, i.e. what his revelation was able to construct was a system that sanctifies the divinity of the individual, that uses truth to do that. And so I just found it very interesting and perhaps not that coincidental that the same process was taking place just within a different technological paradigm or era, but not much of a fundamental distinction between either the process or the wisdom that his historical counterpart might have been engaging in.
Very fascinating. And you also wrote that you personally think that the protocol should not be changed in the future. Mm-hmm. I tend to agree. I mean, and to keep it this pure as a placeholder for humanity, because I think Bitcoin can help us to turn from an outside-in society to an inside-out society. And also you write about this in your article that it sort of influences people to become more honest. And as it grows and it keeps being this strong, pure force, people will start to look at themselves and why they are doing what they are doing, and sort of be forced to look inside and start to clean up. Can you see this happening also?
Yeah, I totally see that happening. I see it happening with Bitcoiners as the first cohort that are most engaged and affected by it. And I use a section of the piece to explain it a bit, but you know, in the context of the type of language and stuff I was using in the piece, basically, and I think this happens on many levels, and I think, you know, maybe we don't have time to get into all of them, but the one that I explored was just simply how its influence on your perception and what you perceive to be of value and your systems of value, its influence on that, and the values that it seems to almost emit, you know, the ones I was referring to just a second ago in terms of the primacy of both the sovereignty of the individual and the use of truth to instantiate that, seems to affect people. And it affects people, again, many ways, but just in two very simple ways to observe. One is that honesty and truth and integrity seem to become extremely important to the individuals who are first being influenced by this. And you see that in the Bitcoin quote unquote community, people that are very involved in Bitcoin, honesty, integrity are some of the most important attributes or principles to adhere to. And when people don't adhere to them, they let them know. And then the other thing that happens is because Bitcoin is seen as something of such extreme value, and not just in the terms of like, I have more money, but you know, its value holistically speaking, let's say, that type of value entering your pre-existing systems of valuation creates a fairly dramatic shakeup as far as I can tell. And what it does, I think, is it creates a far more intense orienter of value. And I think anything, what I say in the piece is that a lot of things that can't stand up, comparatively speaking, that are the contrast between whatever thing, other value you hold in your mind and what this thing, i.e. Bitcoin, represents, the ones that can't stand up to that contrast, they get kind of pushed down and pushed out of your consciousness. And the ones that can, they remain and they perhaps become elevated. And because Bitcoin is so valuable for so many different reasons, it seems like the ones that are most capable of remaining are those other sort of transcendent values, like love and like family and like beauty and like family, like truth and like freedom. And these are things that you certainly can't put a price on. And therefore, when they are contrasted with Bitcoin, they're able to stand their ground because they are so extremely valuable. And what you end up having as an effect of Bitcoin entering one's consciousness is the greater concentration of these other things of extreme value. And let's say maybe a greater crystallization or a clarity around their value and why they are valuable. And then of course that has a unavoidable influence on one's behavior because what we value determines our actions and that's our behavior. And so this is why I wanted to include it in the piece, because it's been so evident to me in observing both myself and other Bitcoiners in the space and people that are, you know, learning about and engaging and adopting Bitcoin, that this process is underway. And so I suggested I assume among several mechanisms that might be responsible for what's happening.
Yeah. And then maybe it goes together with a consciousness shift also.
It is a consciousness shift. Oh, like a pre-Bitcoin and consciousness shift, you mean?
Yeah. You know, if you look in Maya calendar and the yugas, and if you look in all these old predictions that we are now entering a new cycle.
Yeah, sure. Maybe.
Like a golden
right?
age and so on. I mean, for sure, my consciousness started rising before I mm-hmm. met Bitcoin, but then it boosted even more. And so what came first, Bitcoin or consciousness evolution? I don't know. Maybe
it's an ongoing process, right? So it's really just a matter of which things are inspiring what degree of impact or change or influence. And, you know, I agree. One obvious one is the emergence of the internet, right? And the facilitation and exchange of information and all that jazz certainly had a massive influence. And, you know, pre-Bitcoin, I was certainly very interested in what seemed to be, you know, a type of evolution or awakening of consciousness going on in the world, coinciding, of course, with, you know, perhaps a calcification or stultification for many other people. But no, absolutely, many things influence our consciousness. I think what makes Bitcoin so interesting is that its effect happens so profoundly and so quickly. You know, I've talked to a lot of people that have only really, you know, been down the Bitcoin rabbit hole for, you know, 6 months sometimes. And the stories I hear about how it's reoriented their lives are very profound. And, you know, as strong as the internet and psychedelics and meditation and all sorts of other pursuits can be, I mean, Bitcoin is definitely up there amongst the ones that have the most rapid and profound impacts, you know, so it's very interesting to me for that reason. And of course, like so many things, for that reason also, it has to be treated carefully. You know, something with such profound power, you want to make sure that you're engaging with it, that your relationship that you constitute with it is properly constituted, because, you know, it as we said before, you know, most things are double-edged swords, and you have to be careful of the dangerous aspect.
It's probably also connected with a placebo effect, maybe, you know, that when people get hope and then they have a reason to make positive changes. And I also saw on Twitter that people that they could get rid of addictions after becoming Bitcoiners and stuff like this.
Yeah, but I wouldn't call that the placebo effect, because it's the qualities of Bitcoin and their understanding of the changes that it can foster that allows that vision of hope to emerge in their mind. And then that vision of hope inspires the change in behavior. So it's still, I wouldn't call that placebo. I'd still say that's inspired by Bitcoin. It just may be, you know, slightly different method of action, for example, in terms of why that change is occurring.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, John, for taking the time to speak with me today. And your very impressive piece. I look forward to reading the next that you present.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to speak with you and to explore some of these ideas. And I'm really glad you enjoyed the piece. It was something I've been wanting to write for a long time, but, you know, writing can be, or at least for me, is quite challenging. It requires a lot of discipline. And so I'm glad that it finally got out. And I think I'll probably take a little bit of break and have these types of discussions and then maybe dive back in and either do something new or expand upon some of the ideas in the existing article. So yeah, thanks, man. It's been fun.
Okay. We will see what the future brings. It's bright in any case.
Absolutely. Okay, take care.
Okay. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.